and welcome to TwerpCast episode 36, the Wacky Racers! Tonight, we'll explore the tell-all biopic written by Penelope Pitstop and Dick Dastardly, Race for Your Life. Long before the pre-NASCAR adventures and Peter Perfect came out of the closet, he was on the casting couch with Muttley and the Anthill Mob. We'll learn about Blubber Bear's steroid abuse and much, much more. Okay, just kidding ya. You really clicked on the right link. Tonight, we discuss Percy Jackson, the Lightning Thief, in PercyCast. I'd like to introduce you to James Caswell, TwerpCast executive producer and Olympian demigod, most likely to spill his wine at the dinner table.
And he's Doug Zeitlin, co-executive producer of Twerps, and the man who, at the tender age of 10, believed for 6 months that his mother had made him out of clay and insisted everyone call him Diana.
The Lightning Thief was written by Rick Riordan in 2005 and published through Hyperion Books. It basically sets the Greek mythology in modern United States. It says everything that you've read about actually happened, and Olympus just happened to move to America. It makes sense in the books, trust me. The first two books, The Lightning Thief and The Sea of Monsters, in their own way, a modern retelling of the Odyssey by Homer, to make it accessible to youth from today, holding fairly accurately to the original, but making it where kids can understand it.
Yes, the series is definitely written for a young audience, your early teen readers, and it's written at their level. Let's be honest, you're not going to find that many 13, 14-year-old kids that are going to want to pick up the Odyssey and read it. This book and this series allows kids to be introduced to Greek mythology on an entertaining level that they can understand. And if they find themselves interested in learning more about Greek mythology, they can then move beyond the series into things like the Odyssey when they become older. It's a great introductory series.
I like the way that the main character, Percy Jackson, is kind of ignorant of his own history, being Greek mythology. They play that against another one of the characters in the book, Annabeth Chase, who actually knows the history. So there's a lot of banter between these two characters where he's like, "What's a Minotaur?" And Annabeth says, "Oh, you dummy, you don't know what a Minotaur is." That gives her character the chance to explain in childlike terms what a Minotaur is, what a quest is, what a hero is.
And thus, explaining it to the audience.
So, I think we've jumped ahead of ourselves. Jim, can you tell us just a little bit about the background of the book and the characters?
Before the events of The Lightning Thief, it is established that the sites of Greek mythology have moved from Greece to the new capital of the world, which is, in this case, the United States.
I want to interrupt you for one moment. And that it's not just an instant happening. It just didn't all of a sudden appear at the United States. Olympus itself moves with the capital of what the Greeks consider the world. So as the Renaissance brought Europe to the capital of the world, Olympus would have been in Europe. As the Industrial Revolution and prowess of America grew, it changed from Europe to America.
Within this universe, mythical magic exists, but it's covered from normal viewing by something called the mist. The mist is a sort of visual barrier that doesn't allow humans to truly see what's going on. It hides mythical creatures and makes them look like everyday things or people. This is the way that they explain how all of these mythical things can be going on while at the same time people aren't really noticing it.
For instance, a mythical character may have a sword in their hand, but a human under the purview of the mist will see a gun.
The Greek gods are still around in modern day, and they're still doing that thing that the Greek gods did best.
Getting some!
Breeding with human beings. As such, there are a lot of demigods running around. All of the gods are doing this save for the big three. The big three in this case being Zeus, Hades, and Poseidon. Those three, shortly after World War II, came to an agreement that they weren't going to have any more offspring because they turned out to be just too powerful.
The implication being that Hitler, Churchill, and Roosevelt were all sons of the big three.
Therefore, they have agreed that they're not going to have any more offspring because it just causes too much damage to the world. Greek gods being who they are, though, this vow really doesn't mean squat. The first of the broken vows that is revealed is Percy himself. After many, many, many hints leading up to the revelation that he is the son of Poseidon. He, of course, does not know that he's a demigod until a bunch of big bad nasties come looking for him, and he gets recruited into joining Camp Half-Blood to be trained to become a hero.
Apparently, the way that all of the sons and daughters of the Greek gods find out that they are the sons and daughters of Greek gods is being attacked by various monsters and having to transport themselves very quickly to Camp Half-Blood.
It's actually mentioned within the books that a majority of them don't make it to Camp Half-Blood because they get discovered and killed by these monsters. Which, when you consider how many kids are actually at Camp Half-Blood, and you look at the percentages that must die on the way to Camp Half-Blood, these gods and goddesses are really breeding like cockroaches. Camp Half-Blood is the training ground. It's the place that all the demigods go to get trained by Chiron, the classic mythology trainer of heroes. The camp is also run by Mr. D, also known as Dionysus, who has been put in charge of the camp as punishment for his drunken debauchery.
One of the things that I like about the characterization of the Greek gods is that even though that they're aloof, even though they're immortal, and even though they look down upon mortal beings, they still act exactly like humans. They have all of our flaws, all of our characteristics. Dionysus is a drunk. There's adultery going on. There's vindictiveness. You've got brothers and sisters who hate each other. I finally have the perfect analogy for this. This group of Greek gods could be on Jerry Springer.
Actually, in a couple of cases, we might need to move them from Jerry Springer to Maury Povich so we can get the baby daddy testing going on.
I think that tells you a little bit about the world that the Lightning Thief is set in. Let's tell you a little bit about the people within the Lightning Thief.
Well, we've already mentioned Percy Jackson, and when we are introduced to him in the Lightning Thief, he is our 12-year-old protagonist. He is the hero of the story, and everything is pretty much told from his point of view. It's told third person, not first person, but the narrator is following him around on his shoulder.
Yes, every once in a while he breaks that fourth wall and talks to you, but it's from the narrator's point of view. Like he'll say, then Percy Jackson said, I'll see you later, mother, but I didn't know how long it was going to be.
Before Percy learns of his heritage, he becomes best friends with a person that, within the context of the story, is a young crippled man who he goes to school with named Grover. Now, we later find out that Grover is actually a satyr, and he is Percy's protector, but one of the things that I really liked about their relationship was that before any of the mystical stuff kicked in, Percy went out of his way to befriend this guy who had no friends, which really spoke of Percy's character, in my opinion.
Well, as the books go on, and I won't talk about them, but it does say specifically that Percy's fatal flaw is the fact that he will do anything to protect his friends and family. Once he made Grover his friend, that was the end of it. He protects him. Weirdly enough, Grover's supposed to be the protector.
Another friend that Percy Jackson makes is in Annabeth Chase. If Percy Jackson is the Harry Potter character, and if Grover is the Ron character, Annabeth is the Hermione of the group. She is the daughter of Athena, who is the goddess of wisdom and strategy, and Annabeth exemplifies that ideal of her mother. She is the brains of the group.
There's an incredibly funny scene in the third book, and they're by Hoover Dam, and all of a sudden you have Grover and Percy and another one of the characters who knows Annabeth just starts sprouting all these facts about Hoover Dam. And the other characters are like, how do you know that? And all of them are simultaneously just like, Annabeth.
Yeah, Annabeth's big passion is architecture. She loves the design of architecture, and her ambition is to become a great architect.
Actually, her fatal flaw is her self-confidence. She doesn't want to be a architect. She wants to be the architect.
Yes. She sees no reason why she can't be the best architect in the world. One of Annabeth's lifelong friends is Luke Castilian, who is the son of Hermes, and who is looked up to by many at Camp Half-Blood. He's in charge of the Hermes house, and a lot of the half-bloods who don't know who their mother or father is gets put into Camp Hermes because he is, among other things, the patron god of travelers. Luke and Annabeth have a good deal of history that gets divulged as the books progress, and along with Annabeth is one of the first friends that Percy makes, because as he first comes into Camp Half-Blood, he doesn't know that Poseidon is his father, and therefore he gets put into the Hermes cabin. And there are lots of other characters that get introduced. Chiron has a very prominent role in things.
Clarice, the daughter of Ares, has an important role to play. That's just a handful of the characters, anyways.
Basically, for every famous Greek god, there is an offspring at Camp Half-Blood at some point or another.
The demigods flow in and out of the stories. You meet Hephaestus's kids, you meet Apollo's kids. It's one of the things that keeps the books fresh as you're reading them.
The Lightning Thief really is an origin story, with Percy learning who he is, what he's capable of. And upon learning this information, we learn that Percy has been accused of stealing Zeus's lightning bolt, the thing that allows him to control lightning.
The story concept behind this is the gods themselves are forbidden to steal each other's powers. They are also forbidden to have direct contact with the mortal world. But the demigods can be influenced by the gods to do anything they want. They can steal, they can influence the human world, whatever.
So the big mystery of the story is who stole Zeus's lightning bolt and why? What was the purpose behind it? Now, keeping in mind that Percy is believed to be the culprit, this starts brewing a war between Zeus and Poseidon, the god of air and the god of sea, which just does not bode well for the world in general. Throwing into this the fact that Hades would love to get his hands on the bolt and drive both of his brothers out of the way.
You've got other gods like Ares, who wants to see a war. That's what he's all about.
That's what gets his groove thing going. So you've got all of these titans clashing, and a war is brewing. And the only person who seems to be able to stop it is Percy Jackson, because he has to produce the lightning bolt. If he doesn't find it and return it, everything's going to go to Hades in a handbasket.
And so now you have the characters, the build-up, and the mystery that makes the Lightning Thief. Without giving away the ending or the story, if you've read the Odyssey, you know a lot of what's going to happen. It's not an exact translation, but a lot of the events that happen in the Odyssey are going to happen in The Lightning Thief. A lot of the characters are the same. A lot of the actions are the same. That's how Percy Jackson figures out how he's going to defeat Medusa. He's like, oh, what was done the last time somebody faced Medusa? To take one step back, probably my favorite little quirk of this universe is monsters don't die. You kill Medusa 3,000 years ago, it just takes a while for her to reform. And that's why the monsters can chase the demigods for thousands of years. Lower monsters reform very quickly. The higher monsters, much slower.
It's going to take Medusa decades, if not centuries, to reform after being killed. So, as we said, The Lightning Thief is a fun story that can draw a lot of interest to mythology, and it's been rather heavily Harry Potter influenced.
I had the same director for the movie.
I really believe that this is a good story that stands well on its own. It is not a Harry Potter ripoff. That being said, though, I don't think it would have become as popular or been as marketable if Harry Potter hadn't been a forerunner before it.
I'm glad that you qualified your statement, because I was going to strongly disagree with you until your qualification. It is in no way, shape, or form a Harry Potter ripoff. J.K. Rowling doesn't have anything on this. Homer, on the other hand, is pretty much up the creek because after a few thousand years, your copyright runs out. And I also agree with your point that even though this is based on Homer's work, that without Harry Potter, you wouldn't have seen this. That the reason that all these characters are children is because they're fighting for the same sales dollars as Harry Potter.
That being said, you have some same basic ingredients. You have the trio that's made up of the lead character, his best friend, and the girl. There's magic involved. One of the things that I actually like about Percy Jackson more than Harry Potter is the fact that the magic that is used has a set of rules and regulations that go along with it. It's based in mythology. He can only use the types of magics that are available through the use of mythology. as opposed to just being able to whip up whatever they feel like. That's in no way, shape, or form putting a blemish on Harry Potter. I love Harry Potter, but I like the structure that gets attached by using these rules.
I think that's a nice basic introduction to The Lightning Thief, the story and its characters. In 2006, Rick Riordan introduced us to the Sea of Monsters.
Set the summer after the events in The Lightning Thief, Grover has graduated to being a pan seeker. Basically, it's a bunch of satyrs that go on out trying to find the lost satyr god Pan. In his searches, though, he has turned up missing. So a good chunk of the Sea of Monsters deals with Percy trying to find Grover, as well as trying to recover the Golden Fleece.
Again, you're going to see a lot of Homer in this work. You're going to see a little bit of that Harry Potter influence, I suppose. You'll get introduced to some new characters and bring back a lot of the fun characters that you remember from the past.
One of the nice things about this series, as Doug had mentioned earlier, is that each new book introduces somebody new and expands upon the supporting cast for Percy Jackson. This particular book introduces a Cyclops named Tyson, and he joins the fray.
The Sea of Monsters was followed up with The Titan's Curse in 2007. Again, new characters are introduced. We have Thalia Grace. You find out about her in books 1 and 2. She's a daughter of Zeus. She is a friend of Annabeth Chase and Luke. She has a strong backstory in the first two books. We also are introduced to Bianca and Nick D'Angelo, the children of Hades. And so now in three books, we've got children of the big three introduced. We've got Thalia, who is Zeus's daughter. We've got Bianca and Nico, the children of Hades. And Percy, who's the son of Poseidon.
In other words, none of the big three were able to keep it in their pants.
They don't call them the big three for no reason.
So, Poseidon, is that a fishing pole in your pocket, or are you just happy to see her?
It's my Ronco pocket fisherman.
And we also get introduced to Rachel Elizabeth Dare, who is a human girl who can actually see through the mist. So the things that Percy Jackson experiences, even though she's human, she can actually see the creatures that he's fighting against, which makes her very unique.
There's a little aside note when they introduce Rachel Elizabeth there that not only is she unique, but that Percy's mother has the same ability to see through the mist.
Yeah, it's a very, very rare trait, and those who have the ability tend to be considered very special. So Titan's Curse deals with Kronos, who we haven't actually mentioned up till this point. Much like in Greek mythology, if the gods are the pseudo-good guys within Greek mythology, and I have to use the term pseudo-good guys, because they're rarely ever truly good, Kronos is the bad guy of the story. He is the father of the gods. He is the one who, upon realizing that they may someday overthrow him, eats his own children, and it's Zeus that manages to rescue them. Yeah, Kronos is not a good guy, and the book makes very good use of that. Kronos ends up becoming a player within the storylines of the books. So as the overall story arc is building, Titan's Curse revolves around him amassing his army, including fellow Titans and his number one general.
In 2008, Rick brought us Battle of the Labyrinth.
As with Hades and Olympus, the Labyrinth has relocated to the United States as well, and it has grown. It is now underneath the entire United States, and you can use it to cross from point to point. Kronos wants to use the Labyrinth as a way to invade Olympus.
Something that we haven't mentioned, which is just a little throwaway, but it's pretty fun anyways. The real way to get to Olympus is to enter the Empire State Building and take the elevator to the 600th floor. A small point that was missed in the movie, but just something cute, I guess. Finally, with the books, in 2009, Rick brought us The Last Olympian.
This was part 5 of the 5-book series, and it deals with the final showdown between Percy Jackson, his friends, and the forces of Kronos. It is the definitive end of this story arc, and an excellent book. I thoroughly enjoyed all 5 of these books, and The Last Olympian really does put a nice capper on the entire series. It has moments of being a little on the long side, but that's because he's trying to make sure he fills all of the open holes. Very well-written series.
Let's put a cap on this by discussing what you think of the books and what you kind of rate them. As far as, like, The Last Olympian feeling a little long, I really felt that way about The Lightning Thief. It's kind of funny because there are places in there where I feel Rick uses the literary shorthand so that he doesn't have to explain a lot of stuff. But then there are other places where his characters explain a lot, and it's painful. There are entire sections that I was like, wow, this is like Anne Rice for kids.
Well, I don't know if I would go as far as Anne Rice, but yes, I do understand what you're talking about. And honestly, I think the reason he's going into that much detail is to draw as detailed of a picture as possible for those who have no clue as to what mythology is. Does he go a little bit overboard at times? Yeah, maybe. But I'm willing to cut him a little bit of slack because he really is trying to paint a large picture for a very young audience.
And that is actually why I gave him a pass on it. If the book had been written for an adult, it was sold in the fiction section, and it was just meant as a piece of literature, I wouldn't have finished it. It was not written for me. But when I consider this book was written for children, and I look at it as a work for young adults, I thought he did an okay job with it. I wasn't offended by the fact that some places were a little long, and some places, like, he just took these shortcuts. For any book that uses Deus Ex Machina as much as this one, at least it literally was the gods.
Again, drawing a comparison back to Harry Potter. I believe that when J.K. Rowling wrote book one of the Harry Potter series, I believe that she was writing it specifically for 11-year-olds. She was writing it with 11-year-olds in mind. She wrote it using 11-year-old dialogue and 11-year-old ideas. As she progressed to the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh book, she also aged her writing style, so that by the time you get to the seventh book, it's concepts and ideas and dialogue that a 17-year-old can identify with. I really do give her the credit to believe that she did this on purpose. Rick did not do that. He wrote for a younger audience without really giving it that much detailed thought. It's not a fault. It's just how I think he decided to write this. That being said, if you're an adult and you expect to be presented with adult ideas, you're not going to get that in this series. These are written for preteen and teenage readers.
I think it's an unfair comparison in some ways, because even though J.K. Rowling wrote for the 11 to 17-year-olds, they were exceptionally accessible by adults. And I don't think that the Olympian series is really that accessible to adults. I think you have to want to read them to really enjoy them. And when I say that, that's not a dig at the books. I really don't mean that in a negative way.
No, I do agree with you. If you're picking up this book with the idea that you as an adult are going to be challenged and that it's going to be very thought-provoking, you're going to be disappointed by the book. If you're picking it up as an adult, realizing that it's written for that teenage age bracket, and you're just looking for something fun to read, it's a wonderful story.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
To cap off the discussion about the books, I will say that The Lightning Thief is a multi-award-winning book at this stage. I was first introduced to it because it was nominated for the Rebecca Caudle Award, which is the Illinois State Book Award Program. Due to my tastes in literature, I was drawn to it and proceeded to gobble up the rest of the series. The fact that it was a multi-award-winning book was not lost on Hollywood. Therefore, they scooped it up and decided to make a movie.
Not as a movie of a book, as its own standalone entity. What did you think of the Lightning Thief movie?
As far as a fantasy film goes, I found it to be very enjoyable. It had a nice pace to it. It had the right mixture of fantasy and adventure in it. It had identifiable characters. And the fact that it dealt with a familiar concept, aka Greek mythology, really did help it. So, as you said, as a standalone entity, I thought it was enjoyable.
I was, and I still am torn about this movie. I actually like Chris Columbus, and I've liked him since long before Harry Potter. Forgive me, but I loved Centennial Man. I know it's not Isaac Asimov's work,
But I thought that Chris Columbus and Robin Williams did a really good job with their story. That being said, Chris Columbus did the same thing again with The Lightning Thief and pretty much disregarded most of the source material. So my original thought to myself was, well, Centennial Man I enjoyed, and it has almost nothing to do with the source material, and can I enjoy this without it being held to its source material? My first thought was yes, because it's really a pretty enjoyable fantasy. But then I thought where the source material came from, and that was Homer, and Rick making Homer accessible to a modern audience. And Chris Columbus, in this case, not only did he ditch most of Rick's work, he ditched most of Homer's work, too. It was just kind of, let's have a Hydra for no reason. Let's ignore everything that's ever been told about Hades. And I thought, I'm kind of disappointed, because Chris Columbus is a pretty good storyteller, and I think even if he wanted to move the story in his own direction, that he could have at least held to the Greek mythology. And he didn't do that. I'm not as angry as the difference from the Lightning Thief book to the movie. But the concept is that the Lightning Thief was supposed to make Greek mythology accessible. And I don't think the movie Lightning Thief makes Greek mythology accessible. I think it just makes special effects. And that's really where it comes from. Not so much that it's not the Odyssey. There's a lot of other material that's not in the Odyssey. The effects were done well, but I think they were more done for the effects than for the storytelling. There was really no reason for there to be a Hydra in this movie, other than the fact that he doesn't know if there's going to be a second movie, and the second book is where the Hydra actually appears, and he thought it was cool. It literally comes out of nowhere.
As an interpretation of The Lightning Thief, I didn't think that this was anywhere close to being a faithful adaptation. As you said, he brings things willy-nilly in from other books that didn't appear in the original text. He writes entire scenes that were never part of any of the books.
Probably about 75% of the movie.
So, as an interpretation of Rick Riordan's work, it was very loosely based. It's very clear that they did not have the same contract with Rick that they had with J.K. Rowling. Because with J.K. Rowling, she said, you aren't going to change anything without my approval. And I want this story told practically verbatim. The movie and the book share a title, a lead character, a very basic same concept. But how the characters get from A to Z, they skip letters and introduce new letters along the way.
The way I talked about Rick taking literary shortcuts, Chris Columbus took storytelling shortcuts just as much. The quest that this group is upon in the book is a lot harder because they're young children, they don't have money, and they're up against a lot of monsters on the way there. Those things are completely skipped. It just says, get from city A to city B. They can take a bus, they can steal a car, however.
In the movie, they're up against three monsters. In the book, they're up against monsters, they're up against gods, they're up against other demigods. These kids have such a rough road to travel that it actually builds upon the character of these three individuals, the fact that they not only survive each ordeal, but they thrive from it. They grow as individuals. Each time they face an adversary and they overcome it, they grow just a little bit more. In the movie, it's like, okay, here's obstacle number one, slap. Here's obstacle number two, slap. Here's obstacle number three, slap. Honestly, it's like, here's act one, here's act two, here's act three, here's our conclusion.
That's exactly what happened, and that's not the way the book was written.
I really have to look at this movie in two completely different ways. As I said, as a standalone film, without comparing it to the book, I enjoyed it. Looking at it as an adaptation of a novel that I really enjoyed, it's horrible. It is in no way, shape, or form the same entity.
I now have a scale for these types of things. Aragon, the worst book interpreted into a movie ever made. That movie was a crime. I want my money back, I want my time back, and I want that director in jail. The Lightning Thief as a movie adaptation of a novel. Passable. Some of the book made it into the movie. Honestly, probably one of my all-time favorite movies is Blade Runner. Has very, very little to do with Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And I love them both. I can handle them as completely separate entities and enjoy them both. This movie's not that good. And my high level would be Chris Columbus's other adaptation, Harry Potter. And I think that both he did a wonderful job of directing and keeping true to the source material.
I honestly wish that Rick Riordan had had a contract similar to J.K. Rowling's, because I really do feel as though the story that was told within the novel was a much better story. And I think that it by itself, being translated to film, would have been a wonderful story. It didn't need all the tweaks that were put into it.
I agree with what you say, but I don't think what you said is strong enough. It's not even just tweaks. It's not like you say, all right, we don't have enough room to put Clarice in. Clarice doesn't need a speaking part, so we're not going to have her in this movie. That's fine. Annabeth Chase is clearly blonde in all of the books, and they couldn't pay for peroxide to bleach, you know, the actress's hair. Those are tiny little things. The fact that there's probably only 5 or 6 scenes out of the books, that's the problem that I have with it.
And the scenes that he put in exchange for scenes that he took out, were not better scenes than what was removed. In fact, I think it's the exact opposite. I think the scenes that he pulled out were far better action sequences, were far better character building scenes, and just all around fit better into the story. Why he felt the need to go in and do such a major renovation to the story is beyond me. This was an award-winning book. People loved it the way it was. Why do you need to go on in and try to tweak it this badly?
Books in the movies hardly ever work. I mean, occasionally you get a mash. The movie had very little to do with the book, but it was a good movie anyway. Occasionally you get a Harry Potter. It is possible to make a novel into a movie and have it be a successful movie. The vast majority of them don't.
True enough. The other pet peeve of mine was, as Doug said, they made a lot of changes. They took a lot of things out. And while the big things that they pulled out bothered me, the small things that they could have left in as sort of Easter eggs for the readers, but didn't, really actually bothered me more. Little things that they could have put in the background that they didn't have to make mention of, they could have just put it in there and left it alone and let the readers of the books sit there and go, look at Annabeth's necklace, it has the 3 charms on it. Look at all the blue in the apartment. Yeah, that's because Percy's mom really has a thing for blue stuff. Yeah, I know about that. I recognize that. And it's stuff that people who had never read the book would have just completely looked over and ignored, but it would have been a treat for the audience that you're trying to draw in, which is the audience that's already read the book.
And you're talking $0 impact on the cost of the movies. Annabeth Chase was already wearing a necklace. If it had simply just been a beaded necklace as it is in the book fans would have known. The apartment where Percy's mom lived. They had to paint the apartment anyways. They could have just used blue paint.
Doug mentioned earlier the color of Annabeth's hair. Again, something very, very minor. Wouldn't have made a big difference to anyone who hadn't read the book, but it's a glaring omission to anyone who is a fan of the book, because every single book mentions Annabeth's long blonde hair multiple times. It and the necklace that she wears are 2 of the big defining things of her appearance. What her face looks like, her body shape, none of that is really given a whole lot of description. The only thing that you really know about her is that she dresses a little bit like a tomboy, she has long blonde hair, and she wears this beaded necklace.
I think there are other changes, though, that are minor that kind of work for the movie. Before the books happen, Luke has a fight with a dragon and he gets a long scar on one of his cheeks. The first thing that I thought when they introduced Luke is, where the hell is the scar? It really bothered me until later in the movie they came up with an alternate reason for the scar. And I was like, oh, I actually kind of like that.
Another glaring difference is, as Doug mentioned earlier, the age of the main characters. I understand why he chose to work with people who appeared to be 16 and 17 years old rather than those who appeared to be 11 and 12 years old. I understand why the change was there, and on a certain level I can agree with it. It messes with the continuity of the story arc, but you can make adjustments for that.
One of the glaring omissions from the movie is prophecy anyways. So once you remove prophecy, it doesn't really matter what age the characters are because the age is important because of the prophecy.
And one of the weird things is that if you look at this movie as a standalone feature, something that may or may not have sequels to it. You don't want to put all your eggs into the basket saying, we'll have more opportunities to tell these stories. Then it makes sense that you don't dwell on the prophecy, that you don't expand beyond the story of that first book. You don't delve into the overall arc. But if you plan on making the Sea of Monsters, the Titan's Curse, the Battle of the Labyrinth, and the Last Olympian, some of the things that they left out, glaring omissions, and they're going to have to make more changes down the line in order to reincorporate some of these pieces back in for them to make any sense. So it almost feels like, well, you should have left them in the first place and not worry about it. Because if they're there and they're in the background, then most people aren't going to pay a whole lot of attention to them anyway. If you make the sequels, then you can bring them to the foreground, but at least they were in the background to begin with.
I have a pro and con example of this, actually. These are both from Harry Potter. A pro example being Jenny Weasley. In the first book, she's essentially a throwaway character. She's the girl in one scene who has a crush on Harry Potter. It's not important. You get to book 6, she's Harry Potter's girlfriend. She's an incredibly important character. But the movies carry Jenny all the way through, and I really like that. The con side of that, Luna Lovegood. J.K. Rowling needed to add her in the book 5. However, when movie 1 came out, book 5 was already out, so they could have had Luna in any capacity in the first 4 movies. They held to the book and just introduced her into 5. So what is better? Oh yeah, Luna was here all along, we just never showed her, or Jenny? We'll show her in a couple of scenes so that when she becomes important, you'll go, oh, that's Ron's sister.
And as the story progresses, there are characters like that at Camp Half-Blood. But with characters like Clarice, who are there at the very beginning, who has a significant role in the very beginning, whose role builds as the story progresses, to not include her in the movie at all, not even as a background character,
not even lip service,
it makes their job more difficult as things progress. This is with me saying there'll be the other 4 movies. I can tell by watching this movie, they don't know whether they're going to make the other 4 movies or not. It all depends on if this one makes money or not.
It's a February release. Could go either way. If it had been a summer release, you know they were expecting more money.
Okay, so we've talked about the changes that were made. How about performances? The leads that were carrying a good portion of this movie were all relatively unknowns. How do you feel that they did?
I thought everybody was pretty good in this movie. I like the kids, I like the adult name actors. I thought it was actually really well presented in terms of acting.
I do agree. Logan Lerman, Alexandria Daddario, and Brandon T. Jackson all played their parts very well. This had a lot of name actors in supporting roles. You have Sean Bean as Zeus, Kevin McKidd as Poseidon, Uma Thurman as Medusa, Pierce Brosnan as Chiron, Rosario Dawson as Persephone. So they put a lot of effort into building a strong supporting cast for this film. And I was very pleased with what I saw of them. If anything, my complaint is that we didn't see enough of them. Would the movie have been better or worse without them? It's hard to say, because now that I've seen Pierce Brosnan as Chiron, I don't know if I could picture anybody else playing Chiron. But then again, he's Pierce Brosnan. It's easy to picture him as the teacher of heroes, even if you don't normally imagine him with
a horse's ass?
Yeah. I think if it had been all 100% no names, I think it might have been detrimental, just because I don't think very many people would go see it. But with such a broad scope of name actors, there are going to be fans of Uma Thurman who are going to come and see this movie just because it has Uma Thurman in it. And there are people who are fans of Pierce Brosnan's who are going to come and see it just because Pierce Brosnan is in it. So I think that having these people in the supporting roles is going to end up helping the cause.
I would agree with that. Ironically, I think there are any number of older actors who could have played Chiron. But now that I've seen it as Pierce Brosnan, now that's like molded in my head. One of the things that I find mildly ironic is a lot of the supporting actors are from the UK, and they all had to do American accents.
Yeah, as opposed to doing Greek accents.
Yes, exactly. I think you see some of the irony there. Sean Bean, Kevin McKidd, Pierce Brosnan, all doing American accents.
Actually, what's really funny is the one person who actually had something of a British/European accent was Melina Kanakardias, and I may have just butchered that badly, I apologize, who is currently on CSI New York, and she is actually of Greek descent. So if she was trying to pull off a Greek accent, more power to her, kind of came across more as a bit British. Which I just found funny because she's well known for her New York/Long Island type accent from being on CSI New York, and then she's the one who pulls off the British accent. It just kind of boggles the mind slightly. Oh, and she played Athena, by the way. So, in the end, it all comes down to dollar amounts, as far as Hollywood is concerned. Do you think this movie is going to make enough money to warrant making sequels, and thus building the franchise out to the 5-movie deal like it is a 5-book deal?
I think the answer to that depends on how much they invested in this movie, and I don't know what they did, honestly. If this is a $200 million movie that's going to pull in $10 million this week, no. No way. If this was a more reasonably priced movie, you know, an $80 million movie, yeah, I think that they might take a risk on a second movie.
I want to see how it does in its second and third week out. After the buzz has gotten out there, after those that are fans of the book get the chance to get the word out as to the kinds of changes that were made and things of that nature, I want to see what kind of turnaround it gets at that time. As you said, it's all about the money. If the studio doesn't make a profit on it, you will not see any sequels. As popular as Aragorn, the book was, the movie did not make anywhere close to the money back, and therefore, you will never see Eldest on the silver screen.
After seeing Aragorn, I say thank God.
It's going to have to make its money back in order to see it go any further. The question that I have in my head is, do I necessarily want to see The Sea of Monsters or The Titan's Curse or any of the other books put to film? Honestly, I enjoyed the book much better than I enjoyed the movie. I enjoyed the series immensely. And I have a vivid enough imagination that I think I can be happy with the movie that plays in my mind more so than the movie that Chris Columbus is going to put on the screen. It's not that I want this movie to do badly. It's that if this is the treatment that these books are going to get, I think I'd rather stick with them as just being books.
My opinion would be, if there's another movie, I would see it. If there's not another movie, I'm not going to miss it.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. I'll agree with that wholeheartedly. So to finish things off, let's rate this movie. Out of the 4 pens in the pocket protector, how many pens do you give it?
I'd give it 2 pens in the pocket protector. I didn't hate it. I didn't love it. It was what it was. It was 2 hours of entertainment.
That was the exact number that I was thinking of, too. 2 pens. If it was an original work, it might have gotten an extra half a pen, but considering that it's based on a book that I really enjoyed and I didn't feel like I saw that book on the screen, I'm probably being generous and I'll say 2.
Well, once again, we thank you for listening to TwerpCast. We would appreciate any of your comments or feedback. Please write jim@twerponline.net. We can also be found on Zanga, Facebook, and MySpace.
You've been listening to a Timewell Electronic Recording production, copyright 2010. Thanks for joining us, everybody.
Shazam!